Hi, this is Drew, and thanks for listening to our podcast. Hopefully, you've been enjoying our show for a while now, but if you're a brand new listener, then the next 50 seconds are not for you, so just go ahead and fast forward a bit. I just wanted to ask our longtime listeners to consider becoming patrons of The Drew Marshall Show, because by throwing us just a few bucks each month, you'll be helping what many tell us is the most brutally authentic spiritual show they've ever heard stay on the air. Look, as loyal podcast listeners, you've been getting the same programming our radio listeners have been hearing live Saturdays 1 to 5 for the last 16 years. Except you get to hear everything commercial-free, you smart consumer, you. Well, because of a brand new arrangement with our studio, our expenses have now gone through the roof. And to be brutally honest, we could use the help to cover those costs. So just before you go to bed tonight, maybe you could stop by our website and click on the giant click here to become a patron sign. And if a whole bunch of you were able to scrounge up like $4 per month, then individually your $4 would have just made a massive difference in helping us cover what it costs to bring you the Drew Marshall Show. Okay, that's it. Sorry to bug you. Now on with the show. I hope you have a good sleep tonight after you become a patron.
And if yours you cannot find, you should talk it over to him. He'll give you peace of mind. When you feel your life's too hard, just go have a talk with God.
A little Stevie Wonder on the Drew Marshall Show. A little talk with God, right? Isn't that the name of the tune?
Yes.
Good pick, Tim.
See? I do good sometimes.
Well, first of all, let me introduce my co-host for this interview, Philip Adsetz. He's the Director of North American Business Development with Kinetico Incorporated. And Philip and I were chatting about all sorts of things the other day, and the name Neil Donald Walsh came up in the conversation. Why? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think you were giving me a bit of your background on the spiritual side of things, talking about religion, and I started getting into the fact that I was not necessarily a religious person.
Yeah.
Not believing in. And then I discovered this book one day, and through that discovery, I read and go, "This is rather remarkable." It resonated with me.
The Conversations with God.
Conversations with God.
Yeah. Which one? Because isn't there like 70 of them?
Yeah. I would say the very first one, and I think only Neil Bill would tell us. In my mind, recollection was something like 15, 16, 17 years ago.
Right.
And my dad now is 93, and interestingly enough, probably 8 years ago, he's just at that stage of life where you start facing your mortality. And
sure.
I said, "Dad, you know, he's been through. He was a Mormon. He was at the Baptist, like just about everything you can name. He
check,
did.
Check, check.
Just an odd thing." I think, all right. So I gave him this book, and I was over at his place just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And there he is with the book on the couch, and every page is ragged. Like it's
he's devoured
it. He's just devoured it, and he's referring back to it again and again and again. I go, wow, what a really remarkable that someone could write something that would have that kind of impact on someone at his stage of life. Yeah.
That is amazing.
Fascinating.
And that's exactly why I reached out to this gentleman, Neil Donald Walsh. Of course, the website you want to go to is neildonaldwalsh.com. Neil has an E on the end of it. Neil Donald Walsh, WALSCH.com. And Neil, listen, I mean, how many interviews have you done? Have you kept track over the years? Because, I mean, you're almost as big as Oprah. This is crazy.
Well, it's really funny when you start looking at the question from both sides, because I spent years in talk radio. I had my own syndicated talk radio program. So if you start adding up those interviews, as well as the interviews that I've had done with those who were interviewing me, we're talking probably 10 or 15,000.
unbelievable. It really is. Listen, I want to introduce you formally to Philip, who's sitting beside me. Philip, this is Neil. Neil, this is Philip.
Neil, real pleasure.
Well, it's nice to be here with you as well. Thanks for the invitation.
Now, Neil, we have about 143 questions to get through in 25 minutes here, so we should probably start. Are you ready?
I am indeed. Go ahead, shoot.
All right. First of all, you know, I think before we can start talking about the, you know, conversations with God, the word God is going to be thrown around a lot in this conversation. What's your definition of God? Because, I know you use the feminine when describing God, but how else would you define God?
Well, I use both the masculine and the feminine. And the question that I'm asked a lot is that very question, what is God? You know, what is God, actually? How do you define that? And my answer is that I don't try to answer what God is. but rather what God is not, because I can answer the question what God is not in one word, and that word would be nothing. So it is my understanding that God is all there ever was, all there is now, and all there ever will be. That is, God is the all of it, the primal energy, the prime force, if you please, the essential essence that exists in, as, and through everything. So that, to put it in simple language, everything you look at, everything you see, everything you observe, the known and the unknown is all God, or divinity, if you please, in some form or another.
Okay, so are we gods, or is God in us, or is it both? God is in us, therefore we are gods. Because through your talks and your writing, I mean, I've picked up a fair bit of sort of pantheistic Gnosticism, and those labels sound like they're so, you know, confining. But I'm just trying to swim in your waters for the very first time, as in depth as possible, and I want to get you the way you want to be gotten. How's that? That sounded like a love song right there.
I'm going to write that down.
Yeah, that was good. Neil?
Yes, you know, it's funny you should use that analogy to swim in the same waters that I'm swimming in, because the answer that I give to that question, you know, are we actually gods, and is God in us, or are we gods? I'm asked that question a lot, and the answer that I give is a metaphor that talks about the waters we're swimming in. And the metaphor is this. I am, and God, by the way, I got this in my conversations with God. I was told, I am to God as a wave is to the ocean. That is, the wave is an individuation, a singularization, a single expression of the larger essence that we call the ocean. But it's in no way separate from the ocean. It is in no way other than the ocean. It is simply a singular expression of the ocean. And when that expression is complete, it recedes back into the ocean. So the metaphor, to my mind, is perfect. We are to God as a wave is to the ocean.
Did you get that, Tim?
Yeah.
He sounds so reticent.
I'm still stuck on the Bible verse about the stars and the grains of sand on a beach. That's where
yeah,
I'm caught up.
Yeah. Philip?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that's absolutely brilliant. And I think that's what resonated with me, was that, like, I've always had a sense of that, that feeling like that, that life is like that, why we're here is about that. So, yeah, very, very, very well stated. I did have a question for you, though, Neil. I have a few, actually. One was, when I read the first book, I got a sense of sort of rawness and authenticity. I had this person searching. Mm-hmm. And then as I started getting into the second book, and I'm seeing you today, and you've become sort of an industry. And I watched it move from that raw exploration to a commercial version. And I'm just wondering how you've reconciled all that, moving from being an explorer to people looking to you as a messenger now.
Yeah, so almost behind that question might even be like, how do you stay grounded now that people see you as Neil Donald Walsh? You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and I want to humbly and honestly beg to differ with you on one observation. I agree with you, by the way, in the main, in your observation. But I don't think it began at book two. I think it began more in book three and then beyond that. Book two is still really an extension of my raw exploration. What's going on here, and what don't I understand? And I don't, you know, how could life, there's got to be a way for life to be better. And I can tell you why I feel that way about book two, because book one, what became book one and two, were really the same moment in time. That is, I didn't write these as books. You understand? Those first two books did not come out of me. I did not sit down and say, you know what, I think I'll write a book about God and having a conversation with God. That's not how it happened.
Right.
How it happened is that I was having an internal process. I call it journaling. I was simply privately journaling and in my notebook, and never dreamt in a million years that anyone would ever see what I was writing in handwriting on my yellow legal pad to myself. And so what became book one and book two were really an extension of middle-of-the-night experience. Now, fair enough, when I got into book three, I realized that I had become somewhat of a source for myself, by the way. I began to see myself in a different way. I began to look at myself and say, gee, you know what, Neil, you seem to have some pretty good answers to these pretty darn good questions. Why don't you just source yourself? Why don't you stop looking, you know, at the religions and talking to priests and lamas and rabbis and all these clerical people? Why don't you just go within and use yourself as the source? And that was really the shift that I think you perceived, as I began to see myself, capital S, that is the larger part of me that I've now come to understand exists in all of us, that is, all of us have access to that part of ourselves that includes the wisdom of the universe, if I could put it that way, and the clarity and the understanding as well. So I began to see myself as my own source, and my writing began to take on that characteristic of, you know, I am the source. And may I add one last thing?
Please.
Without wanting to extend my answer to an hour and a half, but I was told in book one, I was given three words in book one that really shifted my reality on the earth. God said, be the source. And he didn't mean that just for me. She meant it for everyone. It was very clear that she was talking not just to Neil Donald Walsh, but to anyone who happened to become privy to these words. Be the source of whatever it is you want for yourself. Whatever you want for yourself, you want more money in your life, more love in your life, more patience in your life, more understanding in your life, more companionship, whatever it is you want more of in your life, be the source of it in the life of another. And I followed that edict, I followed that suggestion from that point on, and you began to feel that shift in the energetic of my narrative beginning in book three.
Okay, there's so many things that have come out of that I've got to swing around on. The first one is the phrase, God said to me. Now, I was involved in the evangelical scene for 30 years. And then I stepped down as a pastor because I looked in the mirror and said, who are you kidding? There is no way you should be in any form of spiritual leadership. And as I think back on my time with the evangelicals, the phrase God said to me was used time and time again by others to manipulate people in their lives or around them. In other words, it gives them an upper hand in the conversation. Well, God told me that blah, blah, blah. God told me that blah, blah, blah. So how do you argue with some, you know, really? Wow, if God told you, then okay, you win. So I kind of have a weird, a rash reaction when I hear the phrase, God said to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, not only do I know what you mean, you should have that reaction.
Right.
By the way, you have missed the line in all of the conversations. It appears in at least six of the conversations with God Bush, where it's written directly, don't believe a word that you read here. Don't believe a word of what I'm saying. And by the way, God said that to me. Excuse me, but God said to me, don't believe a word that you're receiving in this dialogue. Remain and always insist on becoming your own authority in the matter, your own authority in all spiritual matters, and for that matter, your own authority in all the most important aspects of life. Do not take my word for anything. So whenever I give a talk anywhere, deliver a lecture anywhere, do a workshop anywhere, or write a book, and I've written 37, in every one of the books I make the point very clear, hey, listen, this is my experience, and I'm not going to deny my experience. My experience is that God said these things to me. My experience is also that God is talking to everyone all the time. Hmm. I ask God directly in the book, to whom do you talk? Is it just like the Pope, or, you know, who do you talk to? And God said, in book one, page five, in the fifth page of 4,000 pages of dialogue, it was made very clear, I talk to everyone all the time. The question is not to whom am I talking? The question is, who's listening?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay, hold on. Okay, I'm going to think about something I want to ask you, and while I'm doing that, Philip has got something he wants to ask you, and then I'm going to ask you, and then Philip's going to ask you, and then, you know, you could be here a while, Neil. You could be here all day.
I'm not going to say anything.
I don't mind. By the way, there's nothing magic in my world about 25 minutes, so just take as long as you want.
Okay, all right.
Neil, so you talk about yourself as a source, and then in fact, I grasp that concept that we're supposed to be a source to. We're supposed to be our own source to our lives. But what I notice it fascinates me that people are more interested in your conversation with God than their own. I mean, literally, that's what's built your brand. And I find it's something that you must have also come to that realization that you start saying, okay, I'm not only a source, but am I a coach or mentor? I want people to go out and learn that the concept of the conversation is their concept to own, not mine to impart on them in terms of things that I've learned as I go.
Precisely. I am willing to step into the role that they have assigned to me, because in that role I have the influence to tell them, hey, consider the possibility that you've got this all wrong. Consider the possibility in that you're not really listening to what I'm saying and to what has been said to me. And what I'm saying and what has been said to me is that you are an aspect of divinity, that you are your own authority in these matters. Now, fair enough. If something that's come through me, if something that I've written and put out there is something that you harmonize with, that you resonate with, that you agree with, well, fair enough, as in any other aspect of life. I don't need you to disagree with me, but I don't need you to agree with me either. I need you to promise that you'll take what you're hearing from me deep inside, see if it feels like truth to you. If it does, use it in any way that feels beneficial to you. If it does not, tear it up and throw the book away.
Chatting with Neil Donald Walsh, he's award-winning author of Conversations with God and so much more. Let's just say that. But Neil, so again, coming out of the tribe of certainty known as evangelicalism, now hit a point in my life where certainty, I'm not even sure how to spell that anymore. So I want to ask you, how certain are you that your understanding of God is accurate?
I'm not certain. You know, Larry King asked me the same question on his program many years ago. He said, honey, how do you know that you're right about all this? Do you ever have any doubts?
Yeah.
And I looked at Larry and I said, Larry, the day I stop doubting is the day I become dangerous. And I have no intention of becoming dangerous. The difference between me and some, not all, but some evangelicals, the difference between me and those who believe that the Pope, to mention the Pope, is infallible, the difference between me and some of those other voices is this. I don't declare infallibility. In fact, quite the opposite. I say over and over again, if you go to my website, you'll see it over and over again. If you listen to my speeches that are all over YouTube or anywhere else, you'll hear it over and over again.
Yeah.
I could be wrong about all of this.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny you brought up Larry King. I asked Larry King once if he was afraid of dying. And you know what he said to me? He said, you bet your ass I am. I mean, he is terrified of dying. Yeah. Terrified. Would you say...
Good imitation of him, by the way.
Yeah. He just drops it right down in that range. So are you afraid of dying, Neil Donald Walsh?
Absolutely not. I'm not, because I've had a near-death experience, and I just had open-heart surgery 2 years ago. They did a quintuple bypass. I'm going in for surgery again in a couple of weeks for an aortic aneurysm. So I'm not. I'm actually, honestly, truly not afraid of dying, because I know in my own mind I could be wrong about this. Well, I live within the belief system that I know exactly where I'm going, what's going to happen, and so I'm not afraid of dying. I feel sad that I have to leave this particular. If you ask me if I was sad about it, I'd say yes. If you'd ask me, well, there's a difference between fear and sadness. So I'm sad that if I have to go, I have to go, because I'm really enjoying this. I'm enjoying the people that I love. I'm enjoying my wife, my family, my kids, my dogs. I'm enjoying this life. So I would be sad to leave, but not afraid to leave. And those are distinctly two different experiences.
It sounds like I'm name dropping here now, but when I had Sylvia Brown, no, Sylvia, who's the psychic? What was her name?
Sylvia the psychic.
Stop it. I can't remember her name. Who's the big psychic?
Sylvia Porter?
No.
Just keep talking.
Anyway,
I'll look it up.
Good talk. Could you look into that, Tim? Who did I interview that was a All big right. psychic? She's on the front page of my own website, and I don't even know, I can't remember her name. Anyway, when I asked her about what would happen to her after her death, and then she died, so now she knows what the answer is. She was not as certain as you are. And you sound remarkably, again, to use this word, certain what will happen to you after death. I'm less now interested in your certainty and more interested in the description of what you think will happen after your last breath.
Well, I wrote a book about it called Home with God in a Life That Never Ends. And it's a book-length answer.
Oh,
But in brief, the Reader's Digest version, I believe that, number one, I disassociate immediately with my body. Number two, I disassociate. That is the essence of who I am. I don't lose my awareness of who I am, but I disassociate with my body. I disassociate with my mind even. And ultimately, I even remove myself from the thought that I am the individual that's called my soul. But I ultimately meld in or wind up being immersed in and re-embraced by the essence that I call God. And so I wind up going home again in a life that never ends. Then I can re-emerge. I can emerge once again from the all, if you please, and individuate one more time in another body or at another time in another way, a process that billions of people understand to be reincarnation and totally believe in that process. I'm not the only one on the earth who happens to embrace the notion of reincarnation. So those are some of the things. But, I mean, I wrote a whole book about this, and the book goes into extraordinary detail about what I have come to understand occurs at the moment of what we call death. But to put it in one sentence, death, as we understand it, that is the end of everything, does not exist. Death is. So I asked God directly. I said, okay, enough talk. Give it to me in one sentence. Give it to me, God, in one sentence. What is death? I'm tired of all the. God said, okay, here it is in one sentence. Death is simply a process of re-identification.
Re-identification, right.
Yeah, and Neil, you must recall an interview you had with Don McGill-Roos, where you had a conversation with him specifically about you not wanting to lose your identity as Neil, and it seemed to me that that was rather enlightening to you, that he had a perspective that I've always shared, and that I've always had a sense that when my life is over here, the Philip Adsets I know will no longer be known by me because I will become a part of the collective bigger whole again. And that identity will carry on in life through my daughter and my, you know, the next generations. But it won't matter to me because that's an identity created here. So I got a sense from you that that was an enlightening moment to have that interview with him. And I'll just say one other thing that I found rather fascinating is the concept that scientifically, not a concept, but I guess it is, that consciousness and intelligence is all biological. So as we know ourselves when we pass, if our consciousness, our awareness of being, and our intellect and intelligence is all biological, it all ends there too. What are your thoughts on that?
Ooh, man. Okay, hold on. First of all, Philip, you're not allowed to ask, like, more amazing questions than I am, okay? I'm the host of the show.
All right.
Jeez.
I'll try not to run faster than you.
Nor should you ask questions that are longer than my books.
Nice one. Well, Neil, what do you got?
I think that life exists at two levels, the physical and the metaphysical. When you talk about consciousness and so forth being biological, I'll substitute the word physical for biological. But I think that life exists, I not only think, I've been told directly that life exists at two distinctly different levels, the metaphysical and the physical. And I do not, it's not my understanding that our awareness of the identities of self, the many identities of self, by the way, somehow evaporate or disappear or dissolve when we move from the physical to the metaphysical. Quite to the contrary, I've told exactly the opposite, that when we move from the physical to the metaphysical, that is when we do the thing that humans call die. We wind up on the so-called, quote-unquote, other side and become immediately aware, not only of who we were in the most recent lifetime, aware of Neil-ness, if you will, but of every other identity, temporary as it were, as it may be, of every other identity that the larger essence of my individuated soul has taken on through the course of my evolutionary process. That encompasses many, many, many reincarnations, countless reincarnations. I was told in the conversation, I forgot the exact number, don't quote me on this, but I think it was something like 436 individual lifetimes so far that I have lived. So that would be true of most of us. So we come back again and again in physical life. By the way, fascinatingly, not always on the earth, not always as human entities on the earth, but frequently in other civilizations, in other places in the cosmos, where we also choose to physicalize.
You know, a lot of stuff that is being discussed today. I often try to see if it works across all cultures in my brain. In other words, I kind of, this is a goofy way to explain this, but if something has some spiritual truth to it, I figure that even a hockey player could figure it out once it's explained to them, right? So that's number one. Number two, it should also therefore apply to the, you know, the family living in the hut, the proverbial grass hut in Africa or wherever they are, who don't have any food and they don't have any, you know, whatever. You think we're living, our life is bad. Well, compared to their life, you know, that kind of thing. So when it comes to the whole, I don't even know what the labels are, Neil, but if you just change your thinking, that'll change your circumstances. Well, those folks out in wherever, in the grass hut, they can change their thinking all day long. Do you think that all of a sudden they're going to be, you know, living gloriously well-stocked a life, a gloriously well-stocked life, just because they changed their thinking?
No, I don't. And my friend, you have touched on something very, very important. I have gone around the world the past, by the way, it's 25 years. Next year, it's the 25th anniversary of the book. I've gone around the world for the past 24 years addressing that very topic that you just raised and saying to people, the most dangerous teaching of the so-called New Age is the idea that you create your own reality. Change your thinking, change your life. And I actually verbally denounce that teaching as it's now being shared by people. And I say to people, you know, that's one of the most dangerous teachings and thoughts of people in the New Age. Hmm. And here's why. I tell people that our collective reality is being created by us collaboratively. That is, our exterior reality is being created by us collaboratively. We are all one, and the unit that we are is collaboratively creating our individuated and individually experienced reality. What's meant by the statement that you create your own reality is you create your own experience of the exterior circumstances of life, so that my interior reality, my interior experience of the exterior reality, is how I create my own reality. And the example that I use when I talk to people is, you know, rain on Saturday. Let's just use a real simple example as I use in my lectures. Let's just consider rain on Saturday. It's demonstrably clear that two different people can experience the same objective external reality in two entirely different ways.
Right.
The farmer who's been waiting for months for the drought to end is on his knees, thank you, God, for the rain on this Saturday. Whereas the town's parade organizer, who's worked for 7 months to pull the parade together, the floats and the marching bands and the dignitaries, is yelling at God, "Why? How did you do this to me? How could you, on the one day of the year that we've been in the drought for 7 months and you've been raining on the day of my parade? You're literally raining on my parade. How is it possible for two different people to have dramatically different experiences of the same objective occurrence?" And the answer is, of course, that we are creating our own reality internally. But our external reality is being created by the collective, by the lot of us. It's a collaborative experience. Therefore, and I'll end my diatribe with this, if we want to change conditions for the person in the third world country who can't even begin to think of life the way you and I are talking about it now, just as you fairly pointed out, if we have any part of us at all that wants to recreate those conditions, we have to solve the biggest problem in the world today, which is alienation. Produced by the notion that we are somehow separate from each other, as opposed to the idea that we are all one.
Well said.
If I thought that we are all one, I would never allow 656 an hour, to die of starvation on this planet.
Yeah, well said. Very well said. Of course, we're chatting with Neil. Donald Walsh is on the show with us right now. Can I apologize? Like, I cannot believe, Neil, that I have done this show for 16 years and you have not been a guest. I feel like a real schmuck for taking that long to ask you to come on my show. Please forgive me.
I would not disagree with your definition.
I like this guy.
He's got a sense of humor.
I like him. Fits in well with the Canadian ethos, that's for sure. Neil, who has hurt you the most?
Me. As I look back over my life and I see the things that I've done, both to myself and to others, I am my biggest regret. Or as the wonderful guy who created the comic strip character Pogo from years ago, we have met the enemy, and he is us.
Yeah. Yeah. I tend to fall in love. This is going to sound creepy, but I tend to fall in love. I tend to like people. Let's be less dramatic. I tend to like people who answer that question the way you answered them, because I really, there's enough blame shifting in the world. And if we think back through the trajectory of our own lives, we at some point will begin to discover the role we've played in the fractured relationships in our lives. And usually, you know, well, when it comes to hurt, it's there's vulnerability there. I don't know. I think the whole thing starts off with vulnerability, and then how we react to being hurt is an indicator of where we're at with this enlightenment process. You know, I've just started using the word enlightenment. I always kind of shied away from it. You incense burners freaked me out with the word enlightenment. You know what I mean?
Become enlightened.
Yes. <I know. laughs> Neil, Jesus said that I'm going to rephrase it a little bit. It's a no-brainer to love those that are easy to love. So if anybody's going to be a follower of his, they should try loving those that are hard to love. And that's in the same verse as the whole love your enemy thing. What advice do you have that would correlate with what Jesus said?
Well, first of all, I would point out that Jesus wasn't the only one to say it. The Buddha said the exact same thing. If you study Buddhism and look up on the internet the parable of the saw, he said the exact same thing. If you should be attacked on the side of the road and your thieves would take everything from you and they would actually cut you limb from limb with a two-handed saw, you are to hold no anger toward them. Nor spend any time at all. If you even spend one moment in feeling negative about them, you have misunderstood and misused my teachings.
Wouldn't that be different than loving them, though? That's saying don't hate them. Jesus was saying, no, it's not just about not hating them, it's about loving them. That's a step further, isn't it?
Fair enough, but the energetic is the same.
Yes.
The energetic signature is love your enemies, and pray for those who persecute you, and be a light unto the darkness. And so my experience of that has been exactly that. When I not always in my life, but certainly since my conversation with God, let me share something astonishing that was said to me about this. Understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master. Understanding replaces anger in the mind of the master. Understanding replaces separation and division in the mind of the master. When we understand what causes another person to be, do, and say, and to act as if in the way they are acting, We change our response and reaction to it. And here's what I do when I see other people, whether they're nationally known people, national leaders, or someone across the room in my own house. I ask myself a probing and deeply personal question. What part of me am I seeing over there?
Mm-hmm.
And I do. And that's my discipline. That's my spiritual discipline. I ask myself, is there any part of me that I am seeing over there? And if I can identify any part of me that I've ever expressed in my life that I'm seeing over there, and by the way, inevitably I do, then I notice, oh, I understand. I see how a person could say what he just said, could do what he just did, could lie the way he's just lying, and could behave the way he or she is just now behaving. And then I move to a place where I ask myself a more probing question. Can I forgive myself for acting that way? Because the day I forgive myself for acting that way is the day that I cannot even have to forgive the other person, but simply understand them. And understanding turns into compassion.
You know, I'm thinking about the answer that you said.
By the way, excuse me, one last sentence. I could, by the way, be wrong about all of that.
He's winning me over with that stuff. You know, I'm thinking about the how your response where you said, I was the one who hurt myself the most when I asked you who's hurt you the most. And then this whole loving those who are hard to love kind of thing. And I don't know, to me, I want to kind of get towards that moment where you lived out the great American nightmare, you know, 1 year living as a bum begging on the street. What role did you play in you living out the great American nightmare?
denying who I am and denying what my possibilities are and accepting the cultural story with regard to who I am and what other people were doing to me played a very huge role in that. And I was very clear that in that case I was the source of my own experience.
Hmm.
So it's very, very important for us to recontextualize our lives in that larger way as I see it.
I want to bring Philip in here because, well, he's smarter than I am. Philip?
I actually had, Neil, I've been thinking a lot about this opportunity to talk with you. And I'm going to share something with you. I don't usually put myself out there like this, but then I'd like your feedback on it. So for a lifetime, and this is part of why I'm here today talking with Drew, because I expressed this to him, and he had this strange look on his face. I didn't know he was going to kick me out of his house or give me another beer.
Sometimes it's one of the same.
It's one of the same. So for a lifetime, I've always had a sense of a greater whole, and when I look at things, I feel like there's a universe looking through my eyes as I see it. I've never had a sense of being alone. I've always felt that life to me was not a book where you turn to the first page and keep working through the chapters and you go to the end and the book ends. I've always felt that idea of turning the book on its side and every page is a life. And I've always, like you, sort of trying to explore and understand the concepts of what's going on here and where we fit. I read recently Stephen Hawking, so you mix science and spirituality, and his last book on the answer to the big questions, he said that, this was him speaking now, saying specifically that scientists have determined that the world has many histories. And now, as a huge fan of yours, I think this thinking is pulling us all into a new place, because if the world has had many histories, then from a scientific view and a spiritual view, we're coming back to the same place where we've had many lives. It's just quite fascinating that we could be on the cusp of something really meaningful here.
I agree with you profoundly. And it goes even further than I was. This was discussed in conversations with God, because although I had not read Stephen's book at that time, but we all had the same basic fundamental questions. And by the way, let me just track back a couple of seconds here. Seeing the world as you have described yourself as seeing it is the sign of your enlightenment. But as you're on the journey, you're on the path, and you've had a glimpse. You've had a glimpse behind the curtain, and the wizard says, look here behind the curtain. You'll see that there's more here than meets the eye, more than meets the eye. But trying to go off my train of thought here, I was going for something, and I decided to go on a tangent. I agree with you profoundly and what I asked God the same question, and I said, what's going on? And I was told that, Neil, do you have any favorite movies in the house? I said, yes. On a DVD? Yeah. Take a look at the DVD. The whole story is there. You are simply watching it one frame at a time. But it's all already happened. And in a sense, the whole story has already occurred. And you can fast forward or go back. And it even has alternate endings. Hmm. So what I want you to know is God has said to me, everything that ever was is now and ever will be. Is right now. And are there multiple universes? In my understanding, yes. Are there parallel universes? In my understanding, yes. Have I lived more than one lifetime? In my understanding, yes. Now get this one. This is an interesting one. Have I lived this lifetime more than once? And my answer is yes. I was told directly in conversations with God. It's in the book Home of God that I have lived actually this lifetime as Neil more than once, that when I leave this lifetime, if you please, I have the option to double back, and I get what's known as a universal mulligan. I get to take the shot over, and I get to come back and live this lifetime and reach certain choice points and move in different directions. I get to make different choices, and it's a marvelous experience that we have the opportunity. And by the way, I'm not the only person who has had the experience of having lived this lifetime before. Everyone knows about deja vu. And in the wonderful Broadway show Babes in Arms from 1948, the songwriter wrote an incredible piece of lyrics. And I'm going to read the lyrics to you right now. It seems we've stood and talked like this before. We've looked at each other in the same way then, but I can't remember where or when. Hey, the smile you are smiling is the smile you wore. The clothes you are wearing are the clothes you wore. But I can't remember where or when. You know, some things that happen for the first time seem to be happening again. And so it seems that we have lived before, and laughed before, and loved before. But who knows where or when?
You're freaking me out. Yeah. You're also freaking out some of our listeners. They're calling in. So, okay, that brings me to the... I have three quick questions for you, and then I'll let you have a life again. Thank you again, Neil Donald Walsh, for being on the show. I guess the first question I might have would be, what do you say to all of the Christians who might be listening to our show, right, the evangelicals in particular, who are freaking out about stuff you're saying?
Good for you for freaking out. It tells me that you believe firmly in what you hold to be true, and I would never for one second suggest that you should let go of that. So long as it serves you, serves the idea of love, a love of all people, no matter what they believe or what thoughts they hold, and condemn no one. But good for you for knowing your truth. Stand up for your truth and announce it, even as you are allowing me to announce mine. And as long as we can civilly agree that we disagree, we will move forward in the evolution of the human species.
And I would add to that, live your truth before you preach it.
Couldn't agree more.
That was me just saying a little caveat at the end there. Okay, Neil, what do you believe now that you didn't believe when you first started writing down your conversations with God? Or switch that around, right? I mean, in other words, what are things that you hunkered down on as truth that you now no longer believe to be true, or something you didn't think was true that now is true? Like, I'm so interested in the trajectory of truth in your world.
I think my answer to your question is I no longer believe in an angry, violent, vindictive God. And because I no longer believe in an angry, violent, punishing, and vindictive God, I can no longer embrace and accept as normal or appropriate an angry, violent, vindictive, and punishing human race, mm-hmm. which would do, among other things, kill people deliberately with a thing called the death sentence. That we have a species that actually kills people as a means of teaching people that killing people is not okay.
All right.
And we fail to see the contradiction.
Yeah.
So what I have let go of and what has changed in my belief system is the idea of a violent, angry, and vindictive God. You know, it's time for a civil rights movement for the soul, freeing humanity from their thought that we live in a universe run by a violent, angry, vindictive, and punishing God.
You know, you would... I was just going to say that there's so many interesting things that what you... Do I say this? Because then it might put Paul in a category he may not be comfortable with. So there's a friend of mine named Paul Young. He wrote a book called The Shack. And Paul has been accused by many of the evangelicals of being, you know, uber liberal or new age or, you know, friends with Neil Donald Walsh or something like that, you know. And yet I find the God that Paul wrote about in his book, The Shack, to be more accurate to the scriptures that I've studied over the last number of decades than a lot of the preaching that I've heard. And you and he would probably collide on a few things, but the beautiful common ground, I mean, even just the fact that you can finally, you're using the feminine as well as the masculine to describe an entity that is the creator, which the scriptures very clearly use feminine terms as well. So I don't know, it's the patriarchy of the Western world that has totally screwed that one up. But also with this vindictive, always angry kind of father, he shattered that for me as well. That's probably why I wept while reading his book, and that's probably why I'm going to lose my mind reading all of your books as I go through them over this next year.
One of the most wonderful things that was ever said to me was some lady walked up to me at a lecture a few years ago, and she said, "May I just say one thing to you?" I said, "Certainly. What is it?" She said, "Thank you for introducing me to a God I could fall in love with."
Yeah, well said. I like that. Yep. Okay, let's finish with this. What does Neil Donald Walsh think is wrong with the world today?
What's wrong with the world today is that most people don't know what's wrong with the world today. The biggest problem in the world today is that most people don't know what the biggest problem in the world today is. So they think it's a political problem, or an economic problem, or a social problem, or I know it's a military problem. We'll drop some bombs on it. That's it. Mm-hmm. So we keep trying to solve the problem at every level except the level at which the problem exists. What's wrong with the world today, therefore, is that we are failing to see what the biggest problem in the world today is. It's not a political problem. It's not a military problem. It's not an economic problem. It's a spiritual problem. It has to do with what we fundamentally believe about ourselves, about God, and about life itself. When we alter those and examine closely those beliefs with a willingness to release that which is not working, which is, by the way, almost all of our beliefs, when we are willing to release those beliefs that are no longer working and consider the possibility, just consider the possibility that there may be something we don't fully understand here, the understanding of which would change everything. When we are willing to consider that possibility, we are willing to embrace the possibility of moving forward in our evolutionary process.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said.
Now, here's a question that one person that you need to ask. What is the single most important message in conversations with God?
Neil, what is the single most important message in the conversations with God?
Strange you should ask. The single most important message I received in the 4,000 pages of dialogue is this. I ask God, why isn't my life working? Somebody, come on, help me out. I've tried to obey the rules. I'm not a really bad person. What does it take to make life work? And God said to me with a smile in his voice, sweetheart, it's so simple. You think your life is about you. And your life has nothing to do with you. It has to do with everyone whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it.
I'm telling you, if Jesus people get upset with that, you're worshiping the wrong Jesus. Well done. Well done. Man, well done. It's like obviously, like he needs my approval. Well done, Neil. Jeez. What a pleasure and an honor. It really is an honor to have you on the show. Thank you very much. And it sounds like we might have another conversation a little bit later in the year. You have another book coming out?
Yes, as well as your producer has indicated that I can be on the program every week. So
Wow. You know, the only other guy who was as good a promoter as Neil Donald Walsh was Larry King. When Larry's on the show, he is a walking promotion machine.
Yeah. Mason Creskin was good, too.
Yeah, Mason Creskin was pretty phenomenal. Listen, Philip, here in studio, Philip Adsetz, we're going to have another little conversation with him just before we say goodbye to the end of the show. He's the Director of North American Business Development with Kinetico Incorporated. But the most important thing is that Philip Adsetz and Neil Donald Walsh both have amazing hair.
All right. Very jealous.
Yeah, like I'm bald. Tim, you're bald. I'm looking at you two guys. You're like Paunch from Chips.
Well, we're gonna have to meet sometime. Yeah, I just did want to tell you one thing though, because we on the show earlier, Drew was talking about love and what is love. My wife is my girlfriend from grade 8 public school.
Yeah.
And people say, you know, 45 years later, how does it work?
How does it work?
I always say the same thing. You know, you truly understand love when you look at someone and you absolutely love and adore what you like least about them.
Ooh. That's deep.
And then you get it.
Oh, yeah. I like that.
I love it.
I like it.
That's wonderful.
Neil, have a great weekend. Thank you for joining us on the Drew Marshall Show.
Well, you've made mine a great weekend, so thank you for having me on the program, and let's do it again.
We will. Thank you, Neil. I appreciate it. Bye-bye. Bye.